is happening, everyone? We are coming to you from the Cumberland Farms Lounge at our NBC Sports Boston studios. Cumberland Farms Coffee, just 99 cents any size. That's 99 good reasons to switch. You are listening to the Celtics Talk podcast. I'm Kyle Draper. We got Chris Forsberg and A. Sherrod Blakely. What's up, fellas?
What's going on?
What's up, man?
Dude, I love the fact that we got Forsberg on board now. You guys working together. One guy's on the road in Toronto. The next night, the other guy's in New York. I mean, I don't want to burn you guys out here early in the season. Just take it easy, fellas.
We're trying to pace ourselves. It's a long year. Long year.
Hey, Forsberg, Sherrod needed some help, man. He was struggling last year, dude. I was owning him in all these conversations.
He's still carrying us, but I'm doing my best.
Exactly. Hey, we're taping this one Monday afternoon. The Celtics had a so-so weekend, guys, losing at Toronto, but then winning in New York. And the crazy thing about it, they're not playing great basketball, Sherrod, but here they are, you know, getting wins, you know, even without playing their best game.
Well, that's what the really good teams are supposed to do. You're supposed to have the ability to win games despite not being at your best. And we saw that in New York. Even in the Philly game, I thought they did a lot of good things, but I there was definitely plenty of room for improvement. And Toronto, you know, that was a game that, let's face it, I mean, they had their opportunities in that game. They just could not get it done down the stretch. If you're the Boston Celtics, you're feeling as though, you know what, we're doing what we should be doing this time of year, which is trending towards improvement. That has to be the theme for these guys all season long, because they're not going to be a finished product until they get to the finish line. And for this team, that finish line damn well better be the NBA Finals, because anything that doesn't end with a trip to the finals has to be considered a failure, regardless of the health of your roster.
It's a good thing when you can win games and not play good basketball, because I think we all know this team is going to be better. This is not the team we'll see after 20 games, after 40 games, after 50 games. And you sort of want them to build. You don't want them coming out of the gates like gangbusters and winning everything and looking great. You know, this is going to be a long season. I think you can find encouragement in the fact that they're finding ways to win, even if it takes Trey Burke missing free throws and whatever it takes to get those W's. What I'm more curious to see is, when does it start to click? When do we see what we kind of expected from these guys, and how good can they possibly be?
Yeah, and I understand it's going to click, but I would be okay if this team came out right from the get-go, Chris Forsberg, and went 16 in a row. Come on, man. That's, you know, I mean, think about it. This team lost their first two and won 16 in a row last year. I'm not concerned about Kyrie, but Chris, what are you seeing from Kyrie here in these first three games? Averaging less than 14 points.
Per game.
Exactly. These are
his
not Kyrie numbers.
Are cringeworthy. You know, I think the one thing that's been surprising is he was really good in the preseason. Those first two games, it was like, oh, wow, maybe Kyrie has gone to another level. Maybe he just needed to get that metal out of his knee and it's unlocked him a little bit. But what has been odd is that he took those last two preseason games off, and all of a sudden he's not quite the player that we saw in the preseason. I don't know if it's just still shaking rust. Maybe there was a little extra adrenaline in those preseason games. It has been a little surprising that his shot hasn't fallen. You know, he just doesn't have that touch. He goes to the hoop, gets there, but that when he normally spin it off the hoop, you know, it's just not coming down for him.
Yeah.
And so I feel pretty comfortable that if that's your biggest problem, that Kyrie is going to figure it out. And so I don't think Brad Stevens spends a lot of time worrying about whether Kyrie is going to find it. That being said, you know, it'll certainly make things look a lot better once he does. Like, the offenses look terrible, but, you know, Kyrie works some of his magic. All of a sudden, things get a little bit easier out there for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I don't need to, you know, have some warm milk before I go to bed to rest easy about the Celtics. They're going to be okay, Drapes. I promise. They're going to be okay.
I know that, Sherrod, but tell me, I want to hear from you. What do you think's going on with Kyrie? The numbers aren't there. The shooting percentage, what, 34% or something like that? What's going on with your boy?
I think part of Kyrie's issue right now is, and this will sound crazy, but I'm not sure he's frankly is playing with that killer mentality that he typically plays with. I think he's looking around at his team and he's like, you know what? I know I'm a killer, but I need these other guys to become killers. I need them to understand the power that they possess. I think last season it was about getting Tatum acclimated to being an NBA player. This year, I think Kyrie's mindset in part is to get Tatum acclimated to being an absolute assassin in the NBA. And we've seen that these first three games, he's been incredibly aggressive. And when you watch the way Kyrie plays, it almost seems as though he's comfortable letting Tatum dominate and just be a great player, knowing that as they get deeper into the season, he's going to flip that switch. And then all of a sudden you've got two killer bees to worry about. Then you've got Tatum, who all season long, I think, is going to be really aggressive. And then at some point, I think Kyrie is going to turn his aggression level up another notch. And the next thing you know, that offense will start humming. That defense by that point will already be, I think, you know, kind of solidified as to what they're going to be and how they're going to play. And then you just may have one of those, you know, 9 wins in 10 games, 10 and 12 type runs that we know this crew is capable of putting together.
I love that. Kyrie is the biggest conspiracy guy out there. And even though he backed off from the flat earth.
And I'm buying into this one. I love
Sherrod's theory that he's out there like, I'm not going to go full throttle. I'm going to let these other guys learn what they got to do, figure it out. And then I'll crank it up because we're still winning games. I like that. That's a neat little hot take theory.
Nah, that's a green teamer theory right there from Sherrod. I'm sorry, dude. I got to call you on that. I mean, no, but I'm not worried about Kyrie.
You act as if that's something that would be out of character for Kyrie Irving to do.
Oh, so is that why he's shooting 34%?
What I'm telling you is, do you think it's out of character for him to think like that I need Tatum to kind of become a killer so that once we get to the playoffs, we'll have two postseason killers? You don't think that's something that Kyrie has given some thought to?
Maybe a little bit, but that doesn't.
Oh, okay.
But that doesn't explain 34% and less than 15 points a game, Sherrod. That was the question, Big Fell. That's the topic we're on, not about who needs to be a killer on this team. We know Kyrie's going to get his together, but is he out of shape a little bit? Is he just rusty?
That was amazing. Like, Tommy came out the other night and said that, right?
Tommy mentioned that. Exactly.
You know, and I don't know, because again, the glimpses we got in the preseason was he looked so good and he looked healthy and. You know, I don't know if he maybe just got a little bit complacent with that and downshifted a little bit. I don't necessarily look at him and say he's huffing and puffing up and down the court.
Right.
Well, but I certainly don't believe he's playing at maximum effort. And I don't think that goes for any of the guys right now.
Right. But the one thing that jumps out to me in these first three games is how aggressive other teams are at attacking Kyrie. I think he's had to work a lot harder defensively this year right out the gates than he has in the past. I mean, we're used to seeing teams go at him, but I mean, damn. Fred VanVleet was it was as if Kyrie Irving was like some third string cat that they just brought in off the streets that you are going to make, you're going to build your career off of, that you're going to absolutely crush. And that didn't happen, but that didn't take away from the aggressiveness that they had in as far as picking roles, getting Kyrie in those, and just really looking to attack him. I can see where that could maybe wear him down a little bit, particularly when it's happening with such regularity so quickly out the gate. But bottom line, I'm not worried about this guy. His resume, his pedigree, everything about him tells me that this is just a blip on the radar, that when you look at his body of work this season, he's still going to be a guy that's going to shoot in the mid-40s from the field and high 30s, low 40s from three-point range.
No, I agree. And we're going to ask Bob Cousy, the legend. He'll be on the Celtics Talk podcast. We're going to ask him about Kyrie Irving in a minute. But while Kyrie is taking some time trying to find his game, Jason Tatum, boys, he looks already in midseason form. I mean, Jeff Goodman even tweeted out and said he wouldn't be surprised. It's not a stretch to think that Tatum could lead this team in scoring, Sherrod. I'm not going to go that far, but the young fella has looked great.
Yeah, I'm not going to go that far either, because I still think at the end of the day, you know, Kyrie Irving is the best pure scorer on this team. I had a chance to talk with the GM of the Orlando Magic, John Hammond. And, you know, we're just talking about just, you know, offense in general. And he mentioned how, you know, Kyrie, you know, the best at his position and frankly in the NBA at finishing at the rim. And when you can finish at the rim, that's easy buckets. And he's one of the best in the game at getting those. And so I'm not worried about that. Tatum will have a great season. I think he will be an all-star. But I still think at the end of the day, Kyrie is going to be their top scorer. Tatum will be number two. Both will be going to the all-star game. And the Celtics will live happily ever after.
I'll steer the Jason Tatum hype train, because I believe that he does. If he can find the consistency that it takes to be a night-in and night-out scorer, there is every opportunity for him to be the leading scorer of this team. And I think Kyrie would be perfectly fine with that. Like, I don't think Kyrie's going to sit there and go, man, Jason Tatum's infringing on my territory by putting up 10, 12, 14 shots per night. I think he's perfectly content with that, especially if it could run up his assist numbers and if the offense clicks and if that's just how it naturally plays out. Watching Tatum down there in New York, like, I don't want to overhype what MSG is like, but that was always the big stage that Paul Pierce loved. And we have that whole thing with him and Nate Robinson flipping over him after big hits. Yeah. You know, when Tatum made that little 1 foot fadeaway, it just felt like a Pierce moment. Like a guy who embraces that stage, who likes to step up in that situation. It was just really cool to see, because even though we've already seen Tatum do it in the playoffs and dunk on LeBron, I think we all said, okay, can he carry over to that second year? Can he continue to develop? And for him to step up in a situation like that, irregardless that the Knicks are hot trash, that is a wonderful thing to see if you're a Celtics fan.
Yeah, and the thing that I'm liking is it's not like he's taking 20 shots a game. Most of his stuff, I know, you know, he says maybe he should have passed that last one instead of keeping it, but, hey, the results worked out. But most of his stuff comes within the flow. You know, I don't think he's forcing anything. I don't think he's moving too fast. And the sky is the limit for this kid, Sherrod. And I guess, you know, as we go out through this season, and we'll continue to see it, the thing I love the most is you take away move A, he got a counter move. I mean, this guy just always has a counter. The handle is on point. He just always under control. And to think this guy's 20 years old, you know, it's not a far-fetched to think, you know what, he's an all-star this year. He's, you know, yeah, if not the leading scorer, right there as the second leading scorer.
Yeah, I mean, the Tatum playbook is insanely thick for a guy that young. Typically, when guys come to the league, they've got, you know, one or two go-to moves, and then, you know, over 2 or 3 year process, they figure out counters, because it usually takes people at least a year or two before they can really feel comfortable trying different things. But Tatum, he's got the corner three ball, top of the key three ball, can take you off the dribble, can post you up, can shoot the fadeaway 1 foot off the wrong foot, on the right foot. He can do pretty much everything you would want a young, up-and-coming offensive assassin to do. And as he gets older and he gets more time in the league, he's going to develop even more counters. And he's going to get more, I think, bigger muscle-wise and in mass-wise. And then, you know, that post game is going to get stronger. His off the dribble game will get stronger, because he'll be harder guy to strip and things like that. The sky, and it's so cliche sounding, but it really is true of him. The sky is the limit with this kid.
Drapes, if New York fans were smart, they would have started cheering Tatum during introductions for lineups.
Why? For like 3 years down
bracing for the 2020 summer of 2022. Like, you got no chance of Kyrie. You might as well start shooting for all the rest of the stars. You know, get your next Durant in line.
Yeah, exactly. All right, guys, coming up in just a little bit, we'll talk about some of the things going on around the league. Scoring is way up. And also got to get you guys' opinion on that Rockets-Lakers melee, that fight. Rondo, Chris Paul, Brandon Ingram.
Rondo!
Ding! But first, let's get Gary Pomerantz and the legend himself, Bob Cousy, on the phone. They just came out with a new book. It's called The Last Pass, talking about Cousy and Russell's relationship. That's what we're going to have right now on the Celtics Talk podcast. All right, Gary and Bob, thanks so much for joining us on the Celtics Talk Pop podcast. Kuz, I got to start with you, 90 years old. Celtics fans want to know how you're doing. I'm sure you watch the Celtics as much as possible. Just update us on how you're doing.
Yeah, I try to stay abreast of the team for obvious reasons via television, obviously. I've seen the first 3 games, and I agree with the prognostics who were saying, you know, they're going to take a step forward. They're going to be a legitimate threat to perhaps hang number 18. I think that I agree with the coach. There's a lot of work to be done prior to that. However, they stumbled a little in Toronto, not unexpected. Toronto's got a good strong team this year as well. The Knicks, they should have put away. Even Philadelphia, I thought they delayed in terms of having that killer instinct. And when you get the power, you've got to impose it. And they've got the power now, and they They can't let teams hang around, you know. But anyway, I'm pleased with what I've seen.
Coos, I got to ask you, as a Hall of Fame point guard, what do you think when you see Kyrie Irving out there?
Yeah, I think, in fact, I may say this to him tomorrow. I've also read where Brad has said, you know, both he and Haywood are going to have, I guess, a considerable way to go before they're back to 100%. And that's what I've seen. I've loved Kyrie last year, and I said so. And whenever anyone would ask me about it, I thought he was he's a complete point guard, in that he's obviously such a threat, and he penetrates and finishes about as well as any guard in the league, frankly, yeah, maybe more. But he sees the floor. He's not interested in just he's not just shot oriented. He recognizes the responsibilities of the position. However, with that said, I think both he and Haywood, frankly, are a step behind. I can't really, I guess, explain it properly other than to say my instinct watching him the first three games says that to me, that they've still got a lot of physical work to do, I guess, to get back to 100%.
Coos, is great that they have a 20-year-old, though, that they can lean on. How about Jason Tatum at 20 years old, the way he's playing?
Yeah, no, I've been raving about both he and Brown now, well, last year and of course, this year. I thought, to some degree, we've got to give Danny Ainge a lot of the credit for that. Danny's literally rebuilt this team now in 10 years. Right? When was the last flag? 2008?
Yep.
So, you know, he's put it back together a second time. Not an easy thing to do with 30 teams involved and everybody, you know, fighting like hell to improve themselves every year. In any event, in this case, if I know the facts correctly, Danny, everybody was talking about the kid from Philadelphia as number one, and he did go number one. Obviously, he hasn't produced to that degree, although he did play the other night and didn't look bad. But certainly no Tatum, you know. So it took a little chutzpah, I think, for Danny to make that judgment on Tatum, but he has certainly justified it. God, I agree with you guys. Maybe a little early to give him Hall of Fame status, but he's certainly going to be all league or whatever. And if he keeps improving, I think we can talk about Hall of Fame.
And Coos, last thing on this year's team is just Brad Stevens' birthday today. Still only 42 years old. What are your impressions watching him on the sidelines?
Well, Brad and I don't have a long-standing relationship, but he was nice enough, what was it, last year or the year before, God, having a senior moment. Jeff Twist brought Brad over to Worcester, Massachusetts, which is not easy to get to, as you know. We still have Indian uprisings in Framingham, so the stage only gets through once or twice a week, and it's not easy to get to Worcester. But Jeff and Brad did, and we visited for about an hour. But he's been, what is this, his fifth year?
Sixth year.
Anyway, after each season, I have dropped him a note just congratulating him because, in my judgment, the basic criteria for a successful coach on any level of team sport is to simply get the most out of the materials you have to work with, you know. And anything else is a plus. And each year I've just congratulated them on what the team has accomplished that year and said, Brad, I don't know if they're going to give you the Coach of the Year award, but I want you to know you've got Bob Cousy's Coach of the Year. So with that background, I guess we've developed a bond.
Hey, Gary, I know you and Coos came together on this book, The Last Past, Cousy, Russell, the Celtics, and What Matters in the end. I have a copy in my hand right now. Gary, tell me how this all came about.
Well, it really was a story of trying to find a narrative that would take me right to the end of that subtitle, What Matters in the End. And, you know, Russell and Cousy, they're the Ruth and Gary, that great Celtics dynasty. It's hard to believe, as you say, Bob is 90, Bill Russell is 84. Look, it's rare for a 90-year-old white man to reconsider race and how it played out in his life, and that's what Bob has been doing. He's, you know, in part through our 53 interviews, hard to believe 53 interviews, you know, in his house, his living room in Worcester and down at his condo in West Palm Beach, a number of them on the phone. But it's been a deep self-examination. And, you know, with a lot of great athletes, I think what you see is as they get older in life, they embellish and burnish the stories they tell about themselves. You know, the guppy they caught or fishing grows bigger and bigger until it's a whale. Bob's not doing that. In my interviews, he was emotional and he was engaged and he was intense, exactly as he was as a player. And he drew attention to some of his flaws and admitting to them, drawing attention to them. And, you know, that's unusual. What he was saying in effect was, this is who I was. And it's his dying declaration. I did not do enough. And in that, he meant in regards to his relationship with Bill Russell.
Gary, what stood out most about his relationship with Bill Russell to you as you went through this process?
Well, I mean, in some ways, this is the last pass of the story about the legacy of being a great teammate. And Russell and Cousy, as all your listeners know, were perfectly interlocking pieces on the court. You know, that fast break, which is what Red Auerbach insisted upon, he wanted to punish opposing teams with the transition game, was really all about Russell and Cousy. Russell would get the rebound, turn to make that snap outlet pass to Bob, sometimes even before his high tops hit the floor. And Bob turned and went and was, as we know, the gold standard for point guards in transition. But look, they were teammates for seven seasons, from December of 56 until 1963. If you put that on the civil rights timeline in America, you know, that's about a year, right about the time that the Montgomery bus boycott is ending until the March on Washington address by Martin Luther King Jr. in 1963. That's when they were teammates. And Bill Russell faced, you know, sort of the blast furnace heat from races, you know, in St. Louis, the southernmost city in the league. They would call him names, racial epithets. And in Boston, someone broke into his house and tore up the place and defecated on his bed. It was bad. And now all these years later, Bob, in these conversations with me, has talked about his regrets that as captain of the Celtics, he did not speak out publicly against this racism and that he did not privately pull Bill Russell aside in the locker room and say, Russ, I've got your back.
Cous, and we're hearing Gary there, this isn't a basketball book, really. This is a book wrapped around the era in which you and Russell played. Why did you want to come out and tell this side of the story right now, Cous?
I didn't. Gary talked me into it, I guess. Gary is a wonderful raconteur, and that's the story he decided to tell. I'll be honest with you, Gary knows this. For about the last 12 years, I've been a Howard Hughes of the sports world. I don't come out of my cave easily, and frankly, I haven't given many interviews. So when Jeff Twist called me 2.5 years ago and said, hey, do you want to talk to this guy from the West Coast? He's doing a book on the integration of the NBA and the Celtics' role. Well, I had an interest in that, a long-standing interest, not only from a social justice standpoint, but frankly, Jackie Robinson integrated baseball in 1947. It was international headlines. 3 years later, Walter Brown, our wonderful owner of the Celtics at the time, got up at the league meeting and said, we take Chuck Cooper from Duquesne. And Eddie Gottlieb, I've been told, stood up, the owner of the 76ers, and said, "Walter, don't you know he's a Negro?" And to Walter's credit, he said, "I don't give a damn if he's polka-dotted. Arnold says that he can help us win, so we take Chuck Cooper." So the Celtics drafted the first black player. They had the first black starting five, and they had the first black coach. And yet to this day, guys, I haven't read one single story about the NBA and the integration of the NBA. And the bottom line is simple. Nobody gave a damn. Basketball was so far down the totem pole, sports totem pole, in 1950, that nobody cared whether we were polka dotted or what color we were. There was not that kind of interest in the game. However, now things have changed dramatically. Basketball is the second most played sport in the world. And even in my lifetime, it may overtake soccer. And I was the highest paid player in 1963. I made $35,000. Last year, the highest paid point guard, Curry, from that made $35 million. So, you know, there's been a slight escalation in the acceptance, where the sport is. And someone out there should know the role that the Celtics played in that. In retrospect, I'm very proud of it. I'd give Arnold the credit. Arnold handled it beautifully. He treated everyone, black and white, the same, badly. That's what you want if you're a minority. So anyway, I wanted this story to be told. I had an interest in it, and Gary sweet-talked me into 53 interviews, I guess. So here we are.
Kyle, Chris, let me say this. When I first went to Bob, my interest was in writing a book about the Celtics dynasty. You know, my last book was about a defining football dynasty, the Pittsburgh Steelers in the 1970s with Franco Harris and Terry Bradshaw and Mean Joe Green. And I got a hold of Bob and through Jeff Twiss and went to see him. I also had interviews with Tom Heinsohn scheduled on this trip and Fat Sanders. And when I met Bob, I'm going to tell you, I mean, I knocked on his front door and the door opened and there was an 87-year-old man holding a wooden cane, and on the handle, the fan who gave him the cane had burnt in four letters, COOZ, Cooz. And he welcomed me inside. And we sat together that day for 4 hours. And it was, by any standard, just a remarkable interview. It was clear that Bob had much in his thoughts and much in his heart. He was very emotional in talking about the passing of Missy, his wife of nearly 63 years, 2 years before we started the interviews, and he had a lot to say about Bill Russell. And I decided that day, after 4 hours, and at one point, by the way, he even stood from his chair, balanced on his cane, and was demonstrating for me a dribbling maneuver he used to make. It was a remarkable interview, and it was that day that I decided that the story, the enduring story of that great Celtics dynasty, you know, doesn't live on the parquet floor of Boston Garden. It lives in the conscience of the captain of that team, Bob Cousy.
Cous, Gary mentioned that he felt like he had some regret there. And I guess from your perspective, what was it that you regretted most about that relationship with Russell and what you could have done more?
I don't know. Like, believe it or not, Chuck Cooper and I roomed together the first year. We bonded immediately. Don Barksdale, 3 years later, and I, when Barks got into the Hall of Fame about 5 or 6 years ago, posthumously, the family came to me and asked me to present him in Springfield, and I was so pleased to do that. So at the end of the day, I think it was a personality thing, you know. I took the blame when I talked to Russ about this earlier on. We had a conversation. I did an ESPN thing about, 15 years ago, Gary? And the question like this
2001.
Was asked. Yeah, and I became emotional about it. And I saw Russ at a golf tournament shortly after that, and he came over, threw his arm around me, and said, "Let's have breakfast," and we talked. And he said all the right things, you know, there's nothing you could do, this is the way it is, and all. he tried to make me feel better about it, but part of it was that Russ's personality was such that he wasn't an easy guy to go to and say, "Hey, Russ, come on, let's have a couple of beers after the game," you know. But in my judgment, 60 years after the fact, I was, when Russ joined us in 56, I was the man. I was the captain. I was, I kind of had Boston by the tail as far as the media was concerned. I've always had a good relationship with the media. I was 6 years older. I'm saying to him, I should have reached out to you. You know, I was the senior member. I felt frankly pretty strongly about the race issue. And I should have done more. Gary uses the story in the book where Chuck Cooper and I, after 2 or 3 years together, we were in Raleigh playing this exhibition. I think it was an exhibition. It doesn't matter. Anyway, Chuck couldn't stay at the hotel. Arnold got all shook up over it. Arnold was a fighter. He wanted to raise hell. And we didn't have traveling secretaries in those days, but Chuck and I found out there was a sleeper going through that night at 12:30 to New York with a connection to Boston. We said, "Arnold, don't make a fuss. We'll play the game. Chuck and I'll take the sleeper. We're out of here. Don't worry." So we went, and we didn't, in those days, we had no bad habits in terms of sniffing or snorting or putting anything foreign into the body, but we did drink a hell of a lot of beer. And so we get back to Union Station at 10:30 at night. Train goes through at 12:30. We have 3 or 4 beers. We have to whiz, obviously, about midnight, and we go find the boys' room. And both now, Chuck's from Pennsylvania, from Pittsburgh, thinks he's pretty sophisticated. I'm from the Big Apple. I think I know my way around. Neither one of us. We go. We look at the two black. I can see them to this day. White signs, big white signs, an arrow pointing right saying colored, an arrow pointing left saying whites. I teared up. I didn't know what to say. I was ashamed to be white. I couldn't explain it to this guy who had become my good friend, and we couldn't pee together. So I solved the problem. We went outside to the platform midnight. It was still 30 minutes, so not a lot of people there. We went to the end of the platform, and we peed together. It was a Rosa Parks moment that we couldn't talk about because the statutes hadn't run out, and we had to go back to North Carolina. Anyway, so I had that kind of relationship with Chuck and Barksdale, so I have to think it probably I was a very socially retarded ghetto kid. I spoke funny. I still speak funny. And I was insecure about that, so I didn't reach out easily. With Coop, it just happened very easily, where we bonded as well as Barksdale. Russ's personality, I think, worked against that, but I still should have taken the next step, I think.
Coos, thanks so much. Before we let you go, any words for our guy, Tommy Heinsohn? We see him every day here at the station. Any words you want us to pass on to Tommy?
I'll tell you, Tommy is, I wouldn't tell you this, but he was, in my judgment, the most underrated power forward when he played in the league. He would get 37 points as he did in the first championship, and the headline the next day would be Cousy and Russell. Cousy and Russell. He was playing in the shadow of these two show-offs who got all the headlines, and Tommy was doing the grunt work in the paint and under the boards. Don't tell him I said that, because we don't have to make his head any bigger, but that's the truth. He Tommy, in my judgment, as a player, never got his rightful due.
Great stuff, Coos. Thanks so much. Gary Pomerantz, Bob Cousy. The last pass, Cousy rustled the Celtics. And what matters in the end? Check it out right now. Guys, thanks for coming on the Celtics Talk podcast.
Thanks so much, Kyle and Chris.
Enjoyed it.
All right, thanks again to Gary Pomerantz and Bob Cousy for coming on the Celtics Talk podcast. Guys, before we get out of here, I got to start. What's going on with the Lakers and Rockets, Rondo and Chris Paul, Brandon Ingram getting suspended also? I know you guys saw the fight over the weekend, Chris. What were your thoughts?
One, I can't believe Rondo and CP3 haven't fought before this. Because you think about their history. Like, Danny Ainge legitimately tried to trade Rondo for Chris Paul, I think it was back in 2009. They've all had this little war of words throughout the time. You know that they just don't like each other. I'm sure it bothered Rondo that Danny Ainge lusted after Chris Paul so much during his time here. And it's funny it took this long for them to come to that. I would give Rondo credit for being the sneakiest spitter in the game.
Gross,
when
dude.
You need to super zoom in like seven different high definition.
He almost got away with it.
And,
almost.
I love the people that say it was actually Carmelo who came over and spit. And came out. There's already conspiracy theories that Rondo didn't even spit. But listen, this is why the NBA is so great. That I'm sure LeBron James is thrilled that his 0-2 start is being overshadowed by the off the court and or on the court antics that lead to after the whistle antics. So what an entertaining league. And Brandon Ingram, what a cheap shot. Like, to come running in from half court throwing haymakers.
Right.
That's just wild, but I can't wait for the next time they play. You know what? Whether it's the Rockets, the Clippers, whatever, CP3 gets into trouble in that building. They need to he's just going to stay away from there.
That fight was the most awesome thing we've seen in a long time in the NBA. And I'm going to tell you why. The NBA gets a rap for having fake tough guys. Guys who, if you really dislike a guy, you're not going to do anything to him because you're worried about your money. You're worried about – hell no. Rondo's like, look, you put your hand in my face, I'm punching you in your jaw. And CP3 is like, you push in my jaw, I'm going to punch you back in your jaw. I don't care if we're in the middle of the game. By no means am I endorsing fighting, but under those circumstances, considering all the things that transpired between those two guys, that was an inevitable reaction by both men's parts. But the point that you made earlier, Chris, about Brandon Ingram, what the hell are you doing? Stick man, seriously, what are you doing?
He was pissed off, dude. Come on, Sherrod.
They had picked on him all game.
That was it. But you and I both know that is the cheapest of cheap shots to come all the way from no man's land, swinging haymakers, and acting as if you hard. Come on, dude.
Let's put the focus on LeBron, who just sort of like grabbed CP3, and probably good. He probably de-escalated the situation, but still, you know, LeBron wasn't getting anywhere near the melee.
And you saw where James Harden was, right? Way back.
He started doing the backpedal out there. No, it was
Deion Sanders on the basketball court going into coverage way back.
Exactly. So Ingram got 4 games, Rondo 3 games, and CP3 got 2 games. I do want
a two-piece from Rondo.
And a two-piece, right?
left hand.
I do want to end, guys, on just the scoring around the league. I mean, the Pelicans averaging like 200 points a game. I mean, scoring is no doubt up. Is this good, Sherrod, what we're seeing? Is this what the league wants?
Hell yeah. I mean, that's why they've instituted the rules where you can't rap or do some of the things guys have done in the past defensively to create better flow, better movement with and without the ball for players. And better movement with and without the ball, that is going to generate more great looks at the rim. And these guys are so well-conditioned and trained to knock down shots. You're seeing more and more guys get great looks at the basket. And there's so many different reasons why. I mean, there's obviously, as I just mentioned, the new rules, but also you're going to see more and more teams as we go through this thing have as many guys who can knock down threes on the floor. Look at Toronto. I mean, their lineup is by committee, starting five by committee, based upon having 4 perimeter guys who can knock down threes and 1 big. You're going to see more and more teams go with that philosophy to increase the scoring, which makes the need for having guys who can defend even more of a premium. And that's why I like these new rules for the Celtics, because they are a team that's rooted in defense and they've got guys who can defend at a high level, which I think gives them a chance to be even better than I thought they were beforehand.
I just see Brad looking at game film and being like, why can't our offense do that? The 29th ranked offense, he's probably sitting there thinking, why isn't the ball juiced here? Just like Sherrod said, I think that's the main takeaway for me, is that if this becomes the norm where these high-scoring games just stay this way this season, which I can't see. Like, I feel like we see this all every time, right? The refs call the game away in the preseason. It starts to loosen at the start of the year. Yeah. By midseason, we'll be back to the old way of how they call. But the Celtics are really positioned well because they still have one of the better defenses in the league. But, yeah, sometimes you look at those box scores. Drapes, we're gonna play this game every night this season. How many points did Anthony Davis score tonight? Right. We're gonna give the Pelicans score like 175 points, and we're gonna start guessing how many of Davis had, because man, these numbers are gaudy.
Yeah, and Mirotić going off too. I mean, how long can he keep this up? All right, fellas, we're gonna get out of here. I gotta remind all our listeners out there to download the My Teams app. Go to my Twitter page. I got the link on there for you. You know, that's how you download it. No, this is a way where you can stream all the Celtics games, no doubt about that. Some of the studio programming as well. All your favorite teams are covered, whether it's the Red Sox or in the World Series, the Bruins, Patriots, and of course the Celtics. So go to your app store right now and download the My Teams app. You can listen to our podcast, get stories from Chris and Sherrod as well. You can always subscribe to the Celtics Talk podcast on any of your favorite podcasting apps. Ray Sherrod Blake and Chris Forsberg. I'm Kyle Draper. Peace out.
We're out.